My name is Dick Anderson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
And I'm a grateful alcoholic. My sobriety date is June the 8th, 1977. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor people. My home group is the Macklin Group in Powder Springs, Georgia. We actually live in Lithia Springs, but nobody knows where that is, so we put Atlanta. We're about 30 miles west of Atlanta. And my home group is in Powder Springs, where I am a greeter. And if your group doesn't have a greeter, I would recommend that you get a greeter. Since we started having greeters, we joined that group a few years ago, and we had about 15 people. We moved out in that area when I got cancer. And we started having regular meetings. We started giving everybody in the group jobs, and we went from 15 people to we now have 120 to 130 people out in a small town. And it's because you cannot come to our meeting without getting connected, feeling like you're loved. There's nothing exclusive about it. We make everybody feel like they belong. And so we have a lot of newcomers. We got chips that were given in the 30s, but we also give a lot of one-year chips now. So just for those of you who know, if Don's still in the room, in St. Petersburg, I had set my cell phone to silent, but I had been in there messing with the settings, and it is possible to have the silent setting but set so it will actually ring. Now, I don't know how that works, but mine went off down in St. Petersburg. So, and the small world that it is, I'm actually originally from Louisville, Kentucky, where Don lives, and the guy he was talking about, Billy H., that he got a little personal with, I was his first sponsor. He was drinking while I was working with him, though. And so his higher power was not a garden. It was a girl named Scarlett, who was also drinking while we were working with her. That's why a few years later, I was speaking at a conference in Indiana, and somebody said, "Do you know Billy H.?" And I said, "Yeah, did he ever get sober?" "Sober, he just spoke up here." So you never know. Not through anything that I did for him, though. But I'm glad. I congratulate you on a successful first annual Maryland Roundup of this Woodstock format. I fell in love with it the first time I did it. Bob Darrell started out in Las Vegas about 8 years ago, I think, and then Lee did one down in Cocoa Beach that I participated in about 4 or 5 years ago, and I started one 3 years ago in Callaway. And I don't know of a weekend that is a better way for people new and old to stick right in the middle of the core of the program and the spiritual experience that takes away obsession to drink but also gives us a wonderful life. It's the AA story, I believe, is the best way of having a meeting, because you talk about the alcoholism, the disease, you identify, and then you see the recovery. But what happens at one of these, it's a collective experience where you're listening to 8 or 9 people walk through that story. So it's like one giant AA story, but told with several different viewpoints. And I love the format, and I'm participating in 5 of them this year, and we do one down at Callaway, so obviously I love it. And I want to thank the people that did the work, because it doesn't just happen, Ann and the committee and everybody who did work. I don't know if we had a time when we had everybody who was a volunteer stand up, and we thanked them, but would everybody who worked on this please stand up so we can give you some thanks. You know, the essence of the 12th step, which I'm going to talk about, is love and service. And sometimes it doesn't seem like it when you're on a committee, when you're, you know, 2 or 3 people with 1 or 2 years are arguing about things, that's love and service. But if you learn the tradition so that we learn to love each other above our personalities and realize that the most important thing in the room is that we're looking for what God wants us to do, those kind of things. That kind of what I've learned from that has helped me stay married for 27 years, and I'm a guy that was engaged 6 times before I got here, and nobody would ever marry me. I had some good engagements, but I knew nothing of relationships, and so by being involved in AA, just like I learned to love a drunk unconditionally by staying up with him at night and helping him through 2 or 3 days of detox, that's what I did when I first came into AA, I learned how to get along with people, and some of whom I didn't like. You know, if you like everybody in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. And so, but I had to get along with some people that I didn't like and love them in spite of things. And I learned that in AA. So whatever I do in life, I usually learn in AA in this fellowship. I want to thank Lee for helping plant the seeds, because Lee really has been almost like a Johnny Appleseed of these things, and they're popping up all over the place, and that's a good thing. I want to thank Martha, who helped us in our details of getting here. Susan and Frank and Laura were all waiting for us when we got here. We got here a little bit late. I thought the first meeting started at 8, and I didn't realize there was a 6:30 meeting. The meeting, if you saw, was like, what in the hell am I doing here, and why am I here, whatever the name of that meeting was. But I missed the 6:30 meeting, and but they were here. They took us. They made sure we were fed. We had a wonderful room, basket. It's just been a pleasant experience. So it's been a good weekend. Some a couple of men that I sponsor are here. Jim is here, and John, who works back in the with Lee and the Tapers table, both guys I sponsor, and that's always a privilege for me. And the guys that I sponsor help keep me sober more than anything else I do. They really do. And a lot of friends. Rich and the guys took me out to lunch yesterday, and Lori, Alan, a number of people that are friends of mine that are here. And it makes me feel like I belong, because I'm like everybody else who's gotten up here. You know, I think most of us who do this, we have good communication skills. Many of us have jobs. You know, Don's an attorney, and Ralph was in the speech and debate team, and business leaders and people. You know, so we have communication skills, but we're like everybody else. I mean, you know, what am I doing up here? And I don't know that any of, and it's just a real blessing to feel like we're loved. And the speakers this weekend, this format has developed a group of about 20 or so people that I know that do a lot of these Woodstocks, and it's become a very close family for me. And I love listening to them, every word. I don't want to miss a meeting. I would not have missed the 6:30 meeting if I'd known about it. But I don't miss a meeting. I go to every meeting. I just love listening to it. I learn something new every time. Also, this is a special weekend because it's my wife's 27th Al-Anon anniversary, and so I'll introduce my wife, Barbara. This is a big step, a huge step. It's the step for the rest of your life. It is the payoff for the program. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that's the payoff. That is the payoff. But if I've had a spiritual awakening, I've got all kinds of gifts that are going to happen. And I'm like everybody else that's talked this weekend. I don't actuate anything. I don't know how. I have not had a desire for a drink since I got here. In almost 34 years, I have not had a desire for a drink, but I cannot tell anybody how to surrender, because I see other people that slip, and I don't know the difference between them and me, because as I'm getting ready to tell you, I've been an excellent member sometimes, and sometimes I've been a terrible member. When I was 15 years sober, I was looking for a gun to put a bullet in my head, because when I was about 12 years sober, I decided to quit doing all the service work and get in touch with some issues. And by the time I was 15 years sober, I was in a hotel room in Los Angeles, and I was looking for a gun. Well, now, I've got all kinds of firearms in my home in Georgia, and as it turns out, if you're in Los Angeles and you're trying to commit suicide with a gun, you can't buy one out there. So, just fortunate for me, if I'd have found one, I'd have put a bullet in my head. I don't know that I would take a drink again. And I don't mean that I'm not capable of it. I just think I never had any social drinking. So I never had any good drinking to think back on. But I certainly would put a bullet in my head. And so I had to start over. And I had to learn the principles. So that was the final part of it, to practice these principles in all our affairs. What are the principles? You know, what's the spiritual awakening? The only thing I knew about the 12th step for a long time was we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. And I got that wrong, because what I was carrying was what I had, and that was, I got here, I don't have to drink anymore, so everybody else who's drinking is an alcoholic, and they don't have to drink anymore, and by God, I want to help all of them get sober. And I just went looking for people to help them get sober. And that's what I did, and I did a lot of what we call that 12-stepping. But there's a lot more to this step. The popular approach is to get into that second part and kind of gloss over the awakening and the principles. I want to read one of my favorite parts out of the 12 and 12. It says, the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is its keyword. And that's probably the strongest sentence I can find in anywhere in of our literature about what this says. And it also is very clear when you have an awakening. It says, when a man or woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. And I can tell my spiritual condition by the way I react to situations, primarily in AA meetings. If I sit in an AA meeting, like my home group, and Terry gets up and he starts to say that same thing, word for word, that he always says, I could not and I would not, and he goes into this whole thing, and I sit there and said, good God, is he going to say that again? I'm judging him with my flesh. I'm judging him with my human being. But if I sit there and I say, you know, I am, that guy is here every week, and he takes he goes on Friday night, he goes and takes a meeting to a jail. On Saturday night, he goes to a treatment center, and that guy is one of the guys that just I really need to be thankful for. That's God's eyes. There was a book. I was very blessed. The first tape that I ever heard when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I listened to was a Marine Corps pilot named Sandy Beach. And I listened to this tape, and I had on a bathrobe. I'd just come out of 5 days of DTs, and I had on a bathrobe and these slippers. And he talked about being a Marine and being in a bathrobe and slippers in this mental hospital, and arrogantly talking to a guy who was trying to 12-step him. And the guy was a captain in the Marine Corps, and the guy said to Sandy, he said, well, maybe I'm not doing as well as I might, but one of us is going to be locked up here tonight, and the other one's going home and having a nice dinner with his wife. And I got that. I got that. I didn't hear the part about Yale, or I might not have gotten it, but I got the Marine and being sick. And then somebody put me in a station wagon and took me to an outside meeting, and they had an outside speaker, and it's the first time I heard a live speaker, and his name was Chuck Chamberlain. And he got up, and I don't really remember much of what he said. I do remember he spoke for an hour and 40 minutes. It was late in June. The air conditioning wasn't working in the hall where we were, and everybody was using those funeral parlor fans, you know, that they have in the South. And he spoke for an hour and 40 minutes, and he just had this presence about him, and he had this laugh, and he was obviously whatever he had, I wanted. And I remember him saying that even at a year and a half, he would be walking down the street and he would grab onto a lamppost because he was dizzy. And I have vertigo now. I did a lot of damage when I was drinking. Frank and I shared esophageal cancer, which is 98% fatal. And very few people recover from it. And maybe 50 people a year recover from this cancer. And two of us are at this table. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. But here he is telling me about this, and I identified, I understood that maybe I'm sick. It took me over a year to learn how to read after I got to AA. I had brain damage. I hadn't had any food for 2 years. I'd been doing basically street drinking and just drinking straight whiskey. And I had no clue what to do with anything that you were giving me. All I knew, I was glad I was here. That enthusiasm that we talk about, the word enthusiasm that we see in AA when you come in and people are glad to see you and people laugh and people have a good time, enthusiasm comes from the Greek, entheos. It means God in us. And I think I've been on a spiritual journey all my life, and that's what this step is about. To tell you that, I need to tell you a little bit about the journey that I did go through. What we seek here is humility. And the opposite of humility, while I can't really tell you a clear definition of humility, the opposite of humility is defiance. And I don't know of a more defiant group than us alcoholics when we come in here. But I was defiant all my life. And I believe that my defiance came about because I didn't feel comfortable with people and I didn't feel comfortable with God. And if you're separated from people and God, it's very difficult to have any kind of relationship in this world. It gets pretty lonely in a hurry. I didn't feel related to my family because I came from a family of honor. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I came from a military family and all heroes. The first Anderson here was the... My name's Dick Anderson. His name was Captain Dick Anderson. He was the guy with the first boat across the Delaware on Christmas Day, and he later became a general, Richard Clough Anderson. And he was my great-great-great-great-grandfather. His grandson, who was my great-grandfather, was a three-star general under Robert E. Lee at Gettysburg. My dad's a retired colonel. My little sister's a retired colonel. Her husband's a retired colonel. Their son graduated from West Point. Blah, 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 blah. You can Google our family, and, you know, some people, you Google our family, and you see the arrest records. You can Google our family, and you see all these heroes, and then my arrest record. And I am the first alcoholic of record in my family. I am the first one that I know of to be locked up in my family. And so from the very beginning, I felt disconnected from this family. Now, I feel disconnected. My family was not a family of... They were a family that believed in service, and they believed in love, and they believed in faith. They weren't dogmatic. They didn't go around preaching. They just believed. Stonewall Jackson got his name Stonewall because he absolutely believed that if you're doing God's will, he'll take care of you until it's your time to go, and you can't change that one way or the other. And so he stood up like a stone wall, and he led his troops. That was the kind of family I came from. They weren't at the VFW or the American Legion drinking and telling war stories. They were genuine heroes. My dad's got the Army Cross, which is next to the Medal of Honor, two Silver Stars, one of the most decorated veterans in World War II, and just the whole thing like that. And so I felt separated from them. I felt like I didn't fit in with them. And I don't know why I'm different than them, but I felt different. I didn't automatically get that character that they had. And so I felt separated from them. Now, I saw that they had faith, and I had a very spiritual experience. I didn't feel everything that I was taught before I got here. All of the things that I went to before I got here taught me the same spiritual lesson we're going to talk about this morning. I was a member of Little League. I was a member of 4-H. I was a member of the YMCA. I was a member of Boy Scouts. In Boy Scouts, it says that the way we please God best is by doing something for another person anonymously each day. And that's exactly what we do in AA. But I couldn't get any of this until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and found this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is my secret decoder ring. If you are an alcoholic of my type, the rest of it just doesn't work. It's the same message, but it's packaged differently so that I can understand it. And it saved my life, and it gave me a new life. So I didn't feel like I fit in with anybody. The only place where I could identify with anything at all, I grew up in the 50s, and we had a little thing called a television that was a little black and white television, and even the TV shows that I listened to were good moral teachers, The Andy Griffith Show, and Leave It to Beaver, and Father Knows Best, Ozzie and Harriet. And in all of those shows, you know, if Opie or Wally got off the beam someplace, by the end of the show, you know, Dad had taken his pipe, turned it to one side, said something wise, Opie or Wally got the message, and he got back on the beam. And those became my moral teachers. I didn't feel like I could talk to anybody in real life. Everything was a play acting in real life. But I watched those shows, and I felt like I fit in, and I saw my first big spiritual show when I was about 6 or 7. I went to the drive-in with my dad, the colonel, my little sister, the soon-to-be-retired colonel, the whole group. And we go to the East Drive-In in Louisville, Kentucky, and see a movie. It was the first time I'd seen anything in color, and it was 120 feet wide rather than about 10 inches wide. And it was a movie called The Ten Commandments. And the big book says, lack of power is our dilemma. In fact, it says more than that. We quote that a lot. But this is in the chapter that we agnostics. It says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously, but where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourselves which will solve your problem. That means we've written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. You know, that's the purpose of the big book, to connect me to this God that will provide direction and strength and power and give me whatever I need, like a spiritual father. So I thought maybe that's what's missing in my life. So I went to the drive-in, I see this movie, and the movie was The Ten Commandments. and there was tremendous power up there on the screen. There was this guy with a stick named Moses, and he would take the staff, and he would push it to one side, and the Red Sea would part, and the wind was blowing through his hair, and I thought, that's the kind of power I'd like to have. So I made two decisions that night, much to the surprise of my parents, who did not know I was having a spiritual awakening in the back of the 55 Ford. One was, I wanted to be around whatever that was. And God was listening, and or he was giving me the idea. I don't know. These things I don't know, but whatever. It got planted, and so I make my living writing, producing film. And the second decision that I made was I wanted to be on God's side, because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so the next day, I went down the aisle at Linden Baptist Church, and absolutely gave everything. I was a very emotional experience. I believed that I was given everything to God, that I was connected to God, that I had found God. But I did the same thing a lot of newcomers do when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You come in, you go to meetings, and you're here, but you don't take any steps to change. And I didn't change. And after a little while, I was the same scared little Baptist Boy Scout I was when I walked down that aisle. And I took that to mean, because I didn't talk to adults, I didn't talk to anybody, I felt ill at ease, so I was already disconnected from people. And, you know, I didn't have a sponsor until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. A sponsor is a great thing. They'll actually share with you what's going on. But I didn't have one then, and so I thought that meant that God loved you, wanted you to be happy, would give you all the power, everything you needed, but didn't care for me. He had rejected me. And so I walked away from God. I knew there was a God, but I was afraid of God. And I stayed away from God for a long, long time. And in that process, my next spiritual experience was when I took my first drink. And I had that feeling, the same feeling, only even better, that I had when I had seen the Ten Commandments. Because when I had my first drink, I just felt all that fear fell away. I felt like I was an adult. I felt like I was capable of communicating with people. And a buddy of mine, we were 14 years old. We were camped out, getting ready to go to playing a Babe Ruth League baseball game the next day. And from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk. And we hitchhiked up to a place called the White Castle. And I was always ill at ease. Now I go in here, I'm table hopping, I'm meeting people, I'm talking to everybody, I'm making new friends, there's a redhead behind the counter, I think she likes me, and my buddy Dave's not having the same spiritual experience. And he threw up down the, first, I had never had a cup of coffee either, but I'd seen in Perry Mason where if you order a cup of coffee, it enables you to talk to the police, so I ordered him... So I ordered him a cup of coffee, and it didn't have the desired effect. He threw up down the counter. So if you're looking for a Louisville City policeman at midnight, the best place to find him is at the White Castle. So a couple of them came over and said, "What's the matter with your friend?" "Oh, he just had a little bit too much to drink." "Really? How old is he?" "14. How old are you?" "14. So I was in Louisville City jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was the end of my social drinking. And it really was the end of my social drinking. I had no regular drinking. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could, from that point on. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested 22 times. Only once for a DUI. Because when I got back from Vietnam, I had my uniform in the back with all my ribbons on it. And in those days, if in the South, if you had your uniform, you were a white guy, and driving there, oh, say, you go on, even if you were drunk on your behind. So I probably would have gotten a lot more. But that was one out of the 22. The other 21 times were not crimes of commerce. They were crimes of defiance. I was the guy, if you were pulled over on the side of the road and a state trooper was talking to you, I'd pull in behind you and I'd go to the trooper and say, "What's the problem here?" And my buddies loved me because they would go home and I would be the one in handcuffs. Let's put it this way. I was the chairman of the breakfast committee for my senior prom. I went to a high school that was kind of gifted. We had a lot of kids that had a lot of money. I didn't because I come from a military family. And I just told you about my family. I was embarrassed that I came from that kind of family because they all had money. That's how out of touch I was with real things. I'm very proud of my family now. But so I go to my senior prom. I got arrested because of the way I lived. My family didn't see much of me. I got an apartment with some older boys when I was a sophomore, junior in high school, because as soon as I started getting in trouble, that my dad gave me the, if you're going to behave like that, you can't live here. So I didn't live there. I chose, and I went out and got an apartment. And I would emotionally blackmail my mother, going back and forth to see her occasionally and wreaking havoc. But they found out where I was the morning after our senior prom, because I was locked up at our senior prom for two counts of assault and battery on a police officer. And I thought I knew all about race relations because I had two black kids that I went to school with in high school, and I got along with both of them. But they threw me in, at my senior prom, I was over 18, so I was not a minor. They threw me in the felon tank. There were eight bays, and I was in there with seven other guys. And the next morning, everybody found out who the seven guys were when ABC, CBS, and NBC were showing on the news something that my parents saw, where they found out where I was, when they brought out seven Black Panthers who had been locked up in the West End of Louisville for... We have our proms at the same time as the Kentucky Derby, so there were seven Black Panthers who had been locked up bringing explosives in to blow up Churchill Downs, and me in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. Now, these guys were really defiant, and I thought it was just coincidence I was put in there. Later, somebody who knew one of those policemen, they were very ticked that I got in a fight with them, and apparently my attitude was bad, my language was bad. I heard a lot of things about me that I didn't remember in court, and they thought it might do me some good to put me in with seven Black Panthers. But the Panthers had overheard the fact that I got locked up for hitting a policeman. That saved my life, actually. Sometimes it's good to be defiant. So, you know, that's the way I looked at it. It didn't occur to me I wouldn't have been in jail if I hadn't been defiant in the first place. But I was the only one out of my senior class that got locked up and had that experience. And I'm a writer. I was a writer even when I was in high school. And so I started looking Hemingway, all these things, these experiential things, I went through a period where I didn't drink for a while when I was in college because I was trying to find a spiritual. I was always looking for something. I always knew there had to be something other than this. And I went through a period where I read a lot of Edgar Cayce and Thomas Merton. And I lived in Louisville, Bardstown, Kentucky is where Thomas Merton lived. Everything from Hermann Hesse to just Camus, any of the writers back then. I was trying to expand my mind. Edgar Cayce was a psychic who would put a book under his pillow and absorb it. So I would take books under my pillow and see if... And I did. I honestly, The Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse was about the Buddha, and I was reading about this. I did graduate work in intercultural studies at Transylvania University in Lexington. And for a brief time, I would feel like I had this tremendous spiritual enlightening, and I wanted to go share that with people. But I didn't know how to get along with anybody. That was it. I was looking for some kind of spiritual enlightenment, but I just didn't know how. I didn't believe in God, and I didn't believe in people. So I didn't know what I was going to do with that, but I was looking for it. I mean, that's how inept I was, even before I got to my bottom. And like most of us, I'm not a good drinker, so I never had any good drinking. By the time I was 27, I'd been sleeping on a bathroom floor for 2 years and been evicted from that apartment. And... had a gun up to my head and was getting ready to pull the trigger, and I was cursing God, and I started, got blanket. And then I just said, God, help me. And I put the gun down, and there was a movie I'd seen called Days of Wine and Roses, and there was this scene that filled that room that was where Jack Lemmon walks up to Jack Klugman and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And that scene was more real to me, however it was presented to me. I felt like I was in it. And I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner and called a woman named Helen. And she had just started as the general manager at our central office in Atlanta. And Helen is still at our central office in Atlanta. She's got 43 years now. And Helen said, I know you need help. And she sent out a guy named Jim. And Jim was a railroad man. Here's what had happened. We talk about 12-step work. Days of Wine and Roses was written by one of our members and approved and helped by our General Service Office so that it would portray a realistic AA meeting. It was a meeting in film to me. I sat at where a guy came out and addressed a Marine base and talked to a bunch of people, and his name was Charles T. Wine, and he got up. We thought it was a lecture. It was after my second tour in Vietnam, and I went over there with my drinking buddy, who was a gunny sergeant named Bob, and he smoked a roach, and we both had a couple of cocktails, and we went to our drug abuse seminar, mandatory drug abuse seminar. But this guy gets up, and he says, "My name is Charles T. Wine, and I'm an alcoholic, but I don't drink anymore because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I can almost remember every word he said. I wasn't ready to quit, but he planted the seed. He had carried the message to me. At night, I would stay up drunk watching these movies, and there were these public service announcements that would come on, and they would say, if drinking is your problem, no, if, whatever it was, it was just the same thing all the time, but it says, if drinking is your problem, we have a solution. It was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got the message. And in those days also, Alcoholics Anonymous was big news. So when a conference would come to town, they'd have it on the news, and they'd have people so you couldn't see their face, and they'd interview them because it was news that an alcoholic could get sober. And so over and over and over, when I called the operator on the phone and was getting ready to shoot myself and said, "I need help," and I didn't even have a dime, I just called the operator. She knew about Alcoholics Anonymous and how to transfer me to the central office because someone had carried the message to her. I think sometimes we think this stuff is mundane and everybody knows about it, but that's not true. If you do service work, even if you're just getting people aware that Alcoholics Anonymous is here and exists, you are doing 12-step work. You're helping save somebody's life because you helped save my life, because I wouldn't be here if those things hadn't happened. And the guy put me in a vehicle and took me to a place to dry out, and I had DTs for about 5 days. And from the beginning of that time until now, I received unconditional love, something that I hadn't had before, because nobody knew what to do with me, and a lot of people judged me because of my alcoholism. But the first guy that picked me up, this guy named Jim, he picks me up. He's got a year and a half. He's in, and some people say a year and a half is, you know, or a year is too young to be doing 12-step work. If he hadn't done it, I wouldn't be here. He went to pick me up. I had a gun sitting in my lap, and he talked for me 2 hours with a gun sitting in my lap. And because I was waiting to hear what he had to say to decide whether or not I was going to go ahead and pull the trigger. And he didn't seem ill at ease. He just sat with me and talked to me. And he didn't tell me about me. He told him about himself, because he had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he shared his story, his experience, his strength. And I believed him. And he was very different than me, but I believed him. And I turned my whole life over to him. And he took me to a place to dry out. And on the way there, it was a hot summer day. On the way there, he stopped at an ATM machine. This was 77. It was the year Elvis died, Star Wars came out, and ATMs were just getting really out in the market. And apparently I had not been sent an ATM card, because I really didn't know what he was saying when he said, "I'm going to stop at this ATM machine and get some money." And so this guy was a year and a half sober, lived in a one-room apartment with a hot plate, but he had a brand new car. You know how we are. And so and it wasn't much of a car. It was a Pinto, but but it had the sticker on it, and he said, "Will you be okay?" And he went out to get this money, and $20, whatever it was. And before he could get back, I threw up down the inside of the car. And the only thing that he did was share with me. He just put his arm around me and said, "It's going to be okay." That's the kind of unconditional love that we pass on. And I think that the way we act, the big book says our behavior says more about us than our words. I've actually been to meetings where people complain about newcomers coming because they come from a treatment center. And when I came in, we went any place and every place, and we'd drive 3 or 4 hours to find a newcomer to work with so that we could stay sober. And if somebody has delivered them free to your doorstep, that's 12-step work. The way we live is 12-step work. If this guy had shown himself to be somebody that I didn't want to be around, if he'd gotten mad at me for throwing up because I was sick, the big book says we must remember they are very ill. And he put me in that car, and he takes me to a place to dry out. And from that day until now, I've never been without a group of people that were willing to do anything and everything to make sure that I stayed sober. But I had to go through the spiritual process. The first year was very difficult for me because I couldn't read. I went to 9 speaker meetings, and then we had the meetings after the meetings at the Howard Johnson. And then I went to, but I got connected. I got a job in AA. I was the ashtray guy in my home group. I couldn't think, so they didn't want me to do anything with math. Like make coffee. And so so I was the ashtray guy. At that time in Louisville, if you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learned how to smoke. And I'm going to say this, if you're going to visit Don Major, you better smoke, because I've been to his meeting, and you, after the first 10 minutes of the meeting, you cannot, not only can you not hear, you can't see anybody on the other side of the room. It's still one of those smoker clubs. But I was the ashtray guy, and I cleaned those red, green, blue, and gold ashtrays that looked like Christmas tree ornaments that were round and corrugated so that the ashes stuck to the... But I was a good ashtray guy. And that was 12-step work. They were sharing with me how to become useful. There's no trick to this. Here's the spiritual message. Love and service. To me, spirituality is becoming as efficient as I can at being useful to others. That's all there is to it. We were speaking at the Atlanta Roundup last year, Barbara and I, and while we were there, someone broke into our house and stole... We don't have a lot left because of my cancer. We lost most of our retirement and everything and went into a totally different situation. But they stole $33,000 worth of electronics, all my video gear, all our computers, Blackberries, Palms, you know, all of that stuff. I didn't get mad because I would have been very upset about it even 10 years earlier. But I didn't get mad because my value has nothing to do with any possession that I have. We could live in a small one-room apartment with a hot plate and still be useful to people, and in that area we would have great wealth. One of my favorite films is It's a Wonderful Life, and his life has fallen apart. Jimmy Stewart, because of the money situation. But because he has been useful, the angel, Clarence the Angel, takes him through this whole trip and shows him how people's lives would have been different if he hadn't been there to do kind things for other people. I mean, there's no big mystic, go to the mountain and there's somebody that's going to come down on high and give you spiritual enlightenment. That didn't happen to me anyway. What happened was you can be useful with the tools that I've given you. And if you'll be useful, you'll find joy. And I had no idea what joy was before I got here. I'll talk about the most joyous moment, which will be a strange moment. It's the way I'll close. Because it was that moment came at a time when the body of my best friend Keith Lewis was dying. But it's the most joy-filled moment I've ever had in my life. But that joy comes in knowing that I am a child of God. God loves me. And because of that, every promise in the big book says if I'll do what my Father's asking me, if I'll follow the dictates of a higher power, if I have a new employer, if I'll keep close to him and perform his work well, it says he'll take care of every need. It says follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live a new and wonderful world regardless of your present circumstances. So, you know, I've had terminal cancer and we're living in a different place and we don't have much left, and what we do have left, somebody comes in and steals it all. And I felt blessed because I wasn't tied down to what was stolen, because that's not my worth. That's the change in me. It's not a big significant change on the outside, but it's certainly a big significant change on the inside, because everything about my life was based on what I had and who I'd connected with. And those kind of things. I didn't know how to have relationships. I knew how to have possessions. You know, girls I dated were possessions, which is why I was engaged 6 times and not married. But that I had yet to learn. And in that process of learning, the biggest part of the, you know, we talked about the 4th and 5th step, where I finally, after I'd been sober for a couple of years, got out the fact that I was angry at everybody. If you're disconnected from God and people, you're angry at everybody. And I listed that. And then I got into realizing that I wanted to get rid of those things in me that caused these problems, and I went on. And then the 9th step, where these amends start taking place, is where these powerful things started taking place that started reconnecting me to God to get me to this spiritual awakening. And I was at a church apologizing because I had hated God for so long. I'd really done some damage to some churches, and I'm at a church apologizing to them on a Sunday night. Amends means amending the situation, not just apologizing. And I asked if I could be there for a couple of years to do some work. And on that night, two things happened over the next few months. One was I found a group of people that loved me unconditionally, just like they do in AA. And I found out that my perception of what I learned in that church was totally wrong, that God existed there too. Now, I don't go to that church. I spend most of my time in AA. But I'm free to go to that church because I'm a child of God, the same God that they're a child of. The second thing that happened was I was looking for a meaningful relationship. And there was a beautiful blonde there that night in the church who had never heard anybody apologize to a Baptist church. She was two things that I wasn't looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl. I was looking for a new dancer who needed spiritual guidance. And if I had done the picking, I'd be on my fifth or sixth marriage now. But because I was doing what God asked me to do, and out of fear of sponsor also, which sometimes is the way God talks to us, is out of fear of sponsor, that girl is my wife, who I just introduced a few minutes ago, and she and I have been married for 27 years, and I would not have met her, and she would not have met me, and she needed Al-Anon more than she knew, and it's helped save her life and helped save my life, and we've been partners, and we have the same spiritual mission in life, and I would never have found that kind of relationship if I hadn't been following the directions and working through this process. I have never actuated anything, nor have I been. I'm smart, but I have never been able to actuate anything and have a plan and make a goal and make something happen for God. It's always happened just the other way. I'm doing something, and then it happens. And we didn't know at that point that it was going to happen. I just knew that I felt like she was the one. And then I tried to ask her out, and she wouldn't go out with me. It was 6 years later before she went out with me. She had to mellow out a little bit, and I had to cut off the rough edges, and God got us back together a few years later, and then we married. And that's the way it's happened in many cases. I went back to McCann Erickson, that New York ad agency that I was working for, and I made amends to them. And I told them I had stolen probably $30,000, $40,000 on my expense account, which 30 years ago was a lot of money. And my sponsor told me, when you pad your expense account, don't pay it back. That's called stealing. And so you have to pay that money back. You don't just apologize. You pay the money back. So I went back, and the comptroller was a woman named Heartless, and we called her Heartless because she was so difficult on people. She was tough. And I was scared, and I went to her, and I told her the truth. And I said, I don't have the money, but I'll pay it back. And I didn't get the reaction I thought I was going to get. She started crying, and she said, did you know that there were a group of us who knew you were in trouble, and we've been praying for you? And suddenly we realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I went to one final place to make an amend, and that's the church where my dad is a member. My 89-year-old dad, when my mom died a few years ago, my 89-year-old dad got remarried there 2 years ago to a younger woman. She's 80. And and they're both active. They drive every place. He can't see or hear. He's an old test pilot, so I don't know. But he drives every place. And but that church I went back to because I had actually very angry. I was drinking when we were members over there, and I didn't go to it. But I was angry, and I defaced the place. And I went to apologize, and I couldn't find anybody. And I went into the chapel, and there was nobody in the whole building, but it was open. And I finally realized what I was there for. I had been asking God to keep me sober in the morning and thanking God at night, and I hated God. I resented God. I was angry at God. And I now know that God didn't do anything that required my forgiveness of God. But there are plenty of people that I have forgiven that didn't do anything that required my forgiveness. It was a process I had to go through. So I got down on my knees and started forgiving God. And I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had. I felt like I weighed nothing. I felt like there was a wind that was blowing through my soul. All that anger, all that fear, all those obstacles just fell off my back. And here's what happened as a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, the people in the fellowship who were there with me every day, helping me persistently one day at a time struggle through this. Because I was working with new drunks and staying in somebody's basement, even when I was brain damaged, and learning to love people, that some of whom didn't want what we had, would walk out and go drink again and were obnoxious and not easy to deal with, but I learned to love them. It taught me that I could maybe give my parents a break and love them too, rather than going there and being judgmental with them. I could love people, and I felt connected to people, and you had given that to me. Now I go, because of this, you connected me for the first time, I think, really, in my whole life with God. It wasn't reconnecting me, it was connecting me for the first time. And I suddenly had that thing they call a spiritual awakening. I felt like I was, I felt like I belonged here. I was on a pink cloud for a few months, and then that left. But during that period, I was with a group of men that did a annual house cleaning, and I still do an annual house cleaning because the purpose, our purpose, it says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. I can't do that if I don't keep doing annual house cleanings, keep growing each year and keep them getting better. So I went with this group of old timers and people that were the guys that helped me, my mentors, to a place called Gethsemane, which was the home where Thomas Merton, you know, lived and wrote and so forth. And we just went down there and we stayed around a fireplace and we were open with each other and did fifth steps and all that. Well, the priest came out this time, and I remember him saying things before, and I'm not Catholic, so I don't really get all the stuff, but he came out, and he was talking to us, and he said, "You boys know what God's will is, don't you?" And nobody ventured a guess, but he said, "God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can right now with what God gives you." Now I'm getting the answer to the 11th step prayer, praying only for God's will for us and the power to carry that. He says, do the very best you can right now with what God gives you. And he said, you talk about humility. Humility is just simply knowing who you are and what your job is. God's job is to be God. Your job is to be the son, the father, the brother, the employee, the employer, the friend, the AA member, whatever you are right now. Your job is to do the very best at it you can and be honest in that process. He said, if you have a job that you love and you're good at it, do it honorably and serve others until God gives you something else. If you have a job that you absolutely hate, do it honorably and love others until God gives you something else. And he said, here's why. God sees us, his children, the same way we see our children. And if you men had two boys and they're both 7 years old, and you gave both of them little red wagons. And one of them takes that red wagon around the neighborhood and spreads joy to all the other kids. And the other one takes that red wagon and kicks it aside and said, "I want a scooter." Who would you give more to? I'd been asking God for lots of things, but I'd never taken the stuff he gave me and used it for anybody else, because I wasn't asking for anybody else. I was asking for me. I was only interested in me. Even in relationships, I was interested in me. And a light went on, and my life started to change. I went to an AA luncheon probably a week after that encounter. I was still working at that clubhouse, pouring coffee, living in somebody's basement. And I went to this old-timers luncheon. And I said, I need a job, I need a place to stay, I need a car, I need some money. And if you've ever been around old timers, they don't seem to catch the emergence of our needs. So they were talking about somebody got a new Mercedes, these were really old timers then. I mean, this is, you know, 30 some odd years ago, and they all had 35, 40 years. Here's a guy who got sober in the 40s. And they were the guys that sat in the back of the room, and they just smiled. They didn't seem like anybody was bugging them about anything, and if they talked to you, you were trying to determine what they meant, and they usually didn't mean anything, but they were talking about a new Mercedes, somebody got a new putter, somebody got in a condo in Hilton Head. I didn't even know what a condo was. But anyway, one of the guys said, bring your resume and see me tomorrow after the meeting was over. And so I did. And within a half an hour, I was doing the advertising and press for a guy that was running for mayor. This guy happened to be his finance chairman. wasn't even a party I was involved in. I didn't care about that. It was a job. And I did a good job at it. And within 6 weeks, we had the inauguration. I was the press secretary for the mayor and the director of public affairs for the city. Now, I wouldn't have picked that job because I'm not really interested in politics. But I had been arrested 22 times. So I'd had a lot of actually, they weren't one-on-one. They were three-on-one, usually. Conversations with policemen, many of whom I didn't know their name. How do I make amends to them? We've been killing policemen in Louisville because if anybody reported they had a drinking problem, they lost their pension. So they would just die of alcoholism. People would hide them away and keep sending them to the hospital and they'd die. We started, with my sponsor's help, Jack Sullivan, who had the program for the railroads, started a program of amnesty. The first six guys, the program was, the chief brought them in. I remember the first one was a city policeman who'd wrecked his police cruiser by driving it drunk into a Jefferson County cruiser and then got in a fist fight with the two Jefferson County policemen. So he was getting more than a reprimand. So the chief said, you can go with Dick to AA or you can lose your pension. That was the first six, and most of them chose to go with me. And so, the second or third one we got into the program became the director of that program until he died a couple of years ago. Now, I can tell you I was a floating imbecile at this point. I was trying to think through everything. I'd been brain dead for the first year and a half of AA. Now my brain's working, and, you know, I love words, so I'm talking all this stuff and everything. I was nuts. But because I was in the right place at the right time, God used me anyway. And because I had the right sponsor to set up the program that helped a lot of these guys get sober, I was doing 12-step work. So I reaped the benefits even though I was an idiot and didn't know what I was doing. So you don't have to know what you're doing in order to reap the benefits of this program. You just have to show up and do what people are suggesting you do. And that's the way my life continued. It's been that way for a long, long time. I stayed that way. I continued working. I told you about the problem when I got between 12 and 15 years, and I had to start over. Here's what was missing at 12 years and 15 years in that period. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gone through the process where I had had a spiritual awakening. I'd gone through the second half of this step where I was carrying the message to others. But I wasn't practicing these principles in all our affairs because I didn't know what the principles were. And I'm not talking about the clever ones where they have hope, all this stuff. That's fine. That helps you. Great. But there's just a few principles in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're translated different ways. But they are humility. God has all power. I don't have any power. I can access his power. That's a principle. My job is to be here to be useful to others. That's a principle. My job is to love others. That's a principle. You know, there are just a few principles like that. So how do I translate them? You know, I had never really studied the traditions and about how to apply the traditions and the concepts to my life. I'm going to spend 5 minutes going through the traditions, and I'm going to hope that some of you will start a traditions meeting and learn these principles because they're the ones that have enabled me to find some peace with other people. The 12 steps show me how to live with me. They don't show me how to live with others. In the first step, it's called unity. That's we before me. That means we in here are collectively more important than I am. That means that Barbara and I as a marriage are more important than just my needs or her needs. And when we get into an argument, which we do, Barbara's a very strong woman, and so we get into an argument now and then. If we can't agree on something, we end up praying about it, or we pay the price. But we end up paying out it, turning it over to God, and we've never had it not work out okay. And we're still married. When my friend Keith Lewis died, we set up the memorial service, and I called Tom Ivester first, and we set it up on a date that he could do it, and then Sandy Beach could be there, and John Holmes, and those were the three sponsors for Keith. And then we invited everybody else. And when I got all that set up, I called Tom back to say, we got the date set. It's all ready to go. And Tom said, I've got brain surgery that day. So I said, well, I'll reset this. Tell me when you think you'll be out of that, and, you know, we'll set this anyway. And he said, okay, I'll get back to you. He called me back an hour later, and he said, okay, I've postponed my brain surgery. He postponed his brain surgery because he said, we are more important than I am. and I need to be there for Keith and for the people that love Keith. And Bob Darrell was there. And June Guinan and a lot of other people were there. And we celebrated Keith's life because he made a big difference in a lot of our lives. And that's why Tom Ivester is someplace speaking every weekend, and he's, I don't know how old he is, but he's got 54 years sobriety. And if you haven't heard his story, he's the guy who killed two people driving drunk and later became the warden. That just doesn't happen any place except in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's because he's willing to do these things. The second tradition says that there's only one source of power, and you and I are not it. That gave me more freedom than anything I've ever had in this book. The fact that God has all power means two things. One, it means if I'm God's child and God wants to give me the power I need to deal with a situation, like my cancer or marriage or anything else, he can do it. But the second thing it means is you don't have any power. And if you don't have any power, I don't need to be afraid of you because you can't mess my life up. And I've been giving you all the power in the world. I assigned to you all the power that actually belongs to God. And that messed my life up for a long time, and that's what I was afraid of. And that took the power out of your hands. The third tradition is acceptance without judgment. Unconditional love. When Keith, my friend, started getting sick, I was real angry at him because all I saw was his changed behavior. He lost his sense of humor. He got real self-righteous. He became, you know, everything was about Marine Corps was good, but everything about Catholicism, and he got real dogmatic. I didn't know he had Lou Gehrig's disease and he had frontal lobe dementia. We didn't know that at that point. We didn't know what was going on with him. But he and I were supposed to make a trip together. And so I was real angry at him. So I decided I would call him with my concerns. These are the notes that I wrote for my phone call to Keith where I was going to show my concern. He's been irritable, discontent. He's been depressed. He seemed angry at me, angry at a lot of things and people in the world. When we talked about the anyway, blah, 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 you know, when you're angry at somebody and you're not getting your way, you become concerned. And so but you know what I did? I wrote that, and then I sat down and prayed about it, and I waited a day. I've learned to wait a day or something when I'm angry. And you know, and I thought, you know, that my friend Keith is not like that. There's something wrong here. And if I had sent him that letter, I would have been disconnected, and I would have missed the most joyful hour of my life, which I'll close with. Fourth is independence has its limits. You know, defiance is the opposite of humility. We're in a program where we're asking God to show us how to live, and at the same time we're saying, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And you can't have it both ways. The fifth is, what is my purpose in this? You know, and if I don't know my purpose, when Barbara and I got married and you asked me my purpose, I would have said, well, she's a good-looking blonde, and, you know, I got a nice car, you know. I mean, it wasn't quite that shallow, but it wasn't far from it. And now, if you asked us our purpose in our relationship, it is for us to create a safe harbor for each other where we can go back out of the ills of the storm that we call life and support each other. And because we are both spiritual seekers and want to please God, we help keep each other on the beam. And that keeps us both in God's will, or as much as we can. That's our purpose. That's not what I would have said years ago. But if you don't have a purpose for a meeting, if you don't have a purpose for a job, if you don't have a purpose, how are you going to achieve it? What's it going to do? Let me see. Well, I'm going to skip down here. When you get into the 11th tradition, it's actions speak louder than anything I can say. And that's the biggest part that I've learned, is that our actions say more than our words. We have a lot of very good talkers in AA. Some of us are here this weekend. But the most powerful talking, Ralph gave a talk the other night, and he talked about some of his failures during the last couple of years. And Bob Besant has inspired me since I've been here, because he talks about his failures and about where we are human beings. The beauty of this program is it works on us who are very faulted people. But our actions do say more than our words. And I had an experience not long ago, or a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, and I was sponsoring a new guy, and his wife didn't want him to be in AA. And so we were trying to get her to have some faith in it, she was trying to get him out of AA. And I ended up going into a cell phone, and I go into the cell phone store and tell them that the cell phone not only does not work, but then it was charging me 6 times for the call. And when I said that, the woman didn't, I wanted her to give me a new phone and reduce my bill. And she didn't see it that way, so she told me something else. It turned out she was an employee. She didn't have the opportunity. Only the manager could make that decision. So I should have just asked for a manager. But instead, I treated her like I do some people who don't agree with me. I think they're hard of hearing, so I said it louder. And and when I did, she got upset with me. And then she got the manager. And if I'd asked for the manager in the first place, it would have been taken care of. About 2 weeks later, I'm sitting with this newcomer I'm working with, and he says, "Did you go to a cell phone store recently?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, my wife worked in that store, and she said that you made the lady who worked next to her cry." Well, first of all, she was looking for fault in me. I didn't make the lady cry, but I didn't make her happy either. And I could have solved it a lot easier. But you know what that showed me? There is no place, as far as principles of my affairs, as far as my behavior, there's no place that I should go where I think I can hide out from God or newcomer. My measure of how I should behave in any situation, even if you don't see me, is what if a newcomer was watching me right this minute? Because apparently they were. And the 12th tradition is about giving credit where credit's due, and that is that God always gets the credit. If I'm sober, it's because God helped me stay sober. If we're married, it's because God helped us stay married. And if I'm giving credit to the one who has the actual power, I'll get to use more of that power. Because of that, we've dealt with some very difficult things. We've had some wonderful times. Barbara and I have traveled all over the world. We've been to meetings in about 30 countries and lots of states. We've had beautiful moments. We had a great day in Killarney, Ireland, where it was a beautiful day, and we walked up this long path of four-leaf clovers to the top of a waterfall, and we were looking out at this beautiful lake and the Muckross house and just sitting there crying with gratitude. And you know how we do. And people came by and we were crying. They said, "You okay?"
It's a wonderful day.
And so, but we were having a wonderful day over there. And but other days aren't so wonderful. And in 2005, we had that kind of day. And Barbara and I didn't have any children, but we had an 18-year-old elk hound who's been all over the place going to meetings with us, and we had to put him to sleep, and we were crying because we thought this was the worst thing that could happen. Within just a few weeks, we were the caretakers for her mom and dad, and we put both of them died within a week of each other, unexpected. Her dad died, and then her mom died a week later, and we weren't expecting either one of them to die. And within a couple months, my mom died, and we weren't expecting that. And right in the middle of this, we go to Toronto in 2005, and I come back, and I'm pretty healthy. I'm playing tennis. I'm doing whatever. And I go into for a regular checkup, and I come out, and I'm told that I have esophageal cancer. And I'm told that esophageal cancer of the kind I had is about 98% fatal. And I'm told that there are a few places that have a new procedure where they more advanced than the one that Frank had. The one Frank had, he's even luckier to be alive than I am. But where they take 2/3 of your stomach out, they take all your esophagus out, they take the stomach material, make a new tube, they build a whole upper digestive system. You're on a feeding tube for about, you know, a year. I had about 30 operations, all of this kind of thing. And there are about 2 or 3 places in the world that do this. The headquarters for it is out at University of Southern California. And so I can't tell anybody about this because Barbara's just lost her mom, dad. We put the dog to sleep. So I'm not going to tell her that I've just been told that I have almost always terminal cancer. And because of that, only my prayer partner, Keith Lewis, knew, and only my sponsor knew. A couple other people, medical people, knew. And because you don't gossip, I couldn't tell you. And because I didn't want to get back to Barbara. And so I really was trying to carry a lot of this instead of letting. And my friend Ad Bunim said, "Well, just relax in God's grace." To which I would respond, "Well, you relax in God's grace. I'm the one with the cancer." And no, but you know how we feel. He was right, but that doesn't always mean anything being right. And so I did the homework, and I found where this place was, and they said they would accept me out there. Then they called back and said, we can't accept your insurance. And because of that, I was speaking in Key West on a Saturday, and on that Friday night, I started praying, and I could not pray. If you've seen the sunlight of the Spirit like we do when we have the spiritual awakening, and then you go back to a place of great doubt, it's like you're cut off from everything. And it was darker than I had ever felt in my entire life. And I could not pray. I'm going to die because God can't arrange for me to have the right kind of insurance. And on that Saturday, one of my friends who was speaking there with me said, say whatever prayer you can remember, because I couldn't even pray. And I started reciting the 23rd Psalm, which I had remembered from the third grade. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And it's a pretty good psalm if you're in trouble. And I said it over and over. And right before I went up to speak, I remembered talking to Jack Sullivan, my original sponsor. And he was one of the original guys. They all smoked like smokestacks. And he had lung cancer that led to 6 malignant brain tumors. And I remember he walked out of the office. He had 6 brain tumors. They couldn't operate. He knew he was going to go. And I said, Jack, you don't sound like you're scared. And he said, imagine if God is this good to me here, how great it's going to be on the other side. And that's a promise in the big book. It says, we will lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. And if there is a hereafter, and I'm a spiritual being, and that's going home to the place where I hopefully won't have to have all the character defects I have here, then how can I be afraid of that? And I relaxed once again. I lost my fear. I got up. I talked. I went home, and on Monday morning got a phone call from USC, and they said, we can't handle what you're doing here, but our chief surgeon, who's really our best surgeon at this, just left to go to a place in Rochester, New York. Why don't you call him? So on Monday I called him, thinking I can't even get a call back from my primary care provider, but I'm calling the chief of surgery. And this guy calls me from Rochester, New York in an hour. We send him some film and some labs. He calls me back and says, look, I don't care about your insurance. I'm trying to teach these people up here how to do this procedure, so why don't you get up here as quickly as you can? So now I've got to tell Barbara that I actually have cancer. And we head up to Rochester, New York. And I was ready to make my exit, although if your granddaddy served under Robert E. Lee, you really don't want to go that far north. And so we were a little trepidations about the people. We show up because we had been active. You don't have lots of friends in AA unless you're active. But because we had been active, some people called, and when we got to the little hotel where Barbara would stay the whole time and where I stayed for a couple of days before I went in the hospital, there were 23 people there. They were our new home group in AA and Al-Anon. They took care of Barbara. They did her laundry. They made sure that she got out of the hospital room so she wasn't there with me all the time, because they would put somebody in the room with me. You never realize what a family you have until you need it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there are people that were on this panel who called knowing the trouble I was in and offered to help with finances. And the next day we went to the hospital, and as we walked in, we decided to go check in with God. We went to the chapel, and on the chapel wall, up about 30 feet high, in letters that were a foot and a half deep in gold, it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And we walk out into the lobby to see where we've come to, realizing that God has brought us here. And it's Strong Memorial Hospital, endowed by the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, who started the Alcoholic Foundation, without whom I would not have been here the first time. God works out the details. Whatever our need is. And I was angry at him because I thought he wasn't working them out well enough. I had to go through the process. I had a couple of years that were pretty nasty. And I just like Frank did, we shared that at lunch the other day. But we're here. He and I are both here right now. And so I don't take that to mean, because my friend Keith died, I don't take that to mean that because everybody prayed for me, and they did, that I'm here because I'm a good guy. I take it to mean that there's something else I'm supposed to do, and I need to quit wasting time, and I need to do more of what God wants me to do, and quit spending as much time on what I have or what pleases me. I need to take everything I've got and make it more useful. And I'm doing that. My friend Bill and I we've got a company, and we're working towards producing a one-hour TV series that recovery stories, something tells real recovery stories, spiritual recovery stories, AA recovery stories, not the kind of thing that you see where people are screaming and yelling at each other like intervention and those kind of things, but something that actually carries a message, just like Days of Wine and Roses did to me. And then I own the rights to 16 true life inspirational stories, the kind of things that give people hope. And maybe that'll be my life's work. So that when I'm dead and gone and nobody knows what my name is, they'll see something that I did and it will help change their life. That's the value that we have. What do we leave behind for somebody? So I'm going to share now about the most joyful moment in my life. I was in a room with my friend Keith Lewis. And we only found out he had Lou Gehrig's disease during that last 6 weeks. And I had called and got his three sponsors. And if you ever heard his talk, Dumb Denny, and his sister Patty, and all the characters that are in his talks were in that room. And we've been with him for a couple days. And Lou Gehrig's disease paralyzes you so you can't breathe, and eventually you just stop breathing and you die. And we were in there with him, and he was focused. I've never known anybody that's been so focused on wanting to go home and be with God as Keith Lewis. That's all he talked about. He loved God, and he wanted to be with God. God was his favorite word. And if you haven't heard his tapes, you need to listen to his tapes. So we're in the room with him, and I had been with him just a few weeks before that. And Keith shuffled. He weighed 108 pounds when he died. When I was there, he weighed 120 pounds. He just shuffled around. And even with all of this disability, here's what Keith did during the course of a day. He spent 4 hours in the chapel praying for people, and he knew what he was praying for. He had dementia where he couldn't function very well, but he could figure out things like that. 4 hours. And the rest of the time, he made rosary beads. If you remember his story, he made them for Marine Corps, Army, Navy, and Air Force, and he sent them off. He's doing this in a severely debilitated state. His life had purpose, even then. So we get to the room. My problem with my cancer was that I was asking God to help me with my will. But when I gave up and said, God, your will be done, he opened the doors to Rochester, he opened the doors to Strong Memorial, and my life was changed and saved. Keith was praying, now that he knew he had this, and his will was the same as God's. Take me home and let me home with you. And at 11:30, Sandy, John, Dumb Denny, all of them left. Julia, his wife, was there. She asked me to stay because she was... there was a Eucharistic minister, this woman named Linda, who had this very pleasant voice, and I'm not Catholic, but she was going through some kind of liturgy. And I was holding a mahogany crucifix and holding Keith's hand. And Julia had been up for 3 days. She went around and laid down beside him because suddenly everything became peaceful. And then the last hour that his body was alive, this tremendous spirit came into that room. And we were so overcome with joy that at the moment that Keith's body stopped breathing, Keith was bigger than ever in that room. And we were, his wife, his best friend, were laughing. We were so filled with joy. The most joy-filled moment of my life to this date was the last hour spent with my friend Keith. I had no control over that. I was just there. It's like every other great moment in my life. I just happened to be there and observe it. But if we have a God that loves us so much that the worst thing that's going to happen is we're going to go to paradise, imagine what you can do with your lives if you'll follow these steps and practice these principles in all your affairs. God loves you. God loves me. The best is yet to come, and I hope you enjoy the journey.